arrive, you guys can take five. By the time it's over, no snakes alive. Take the dive. I'm telling you, you're better off than up against the floor to make
up. One, two, one, two.
All right.
One, two.
I think we're good to go. Yeah, it's been great to see the Doom murals around town. There's one right across from where I work on Broadway in Brooklyn, and it was great read this book. I'm talking to S.H. Fernando Jr., a.k.a. Skiz, The Chronicles of Doom, Unraveling Rap's Masked Iconoclast. And it's a little bit of a different episode for us today, but we're going to be talking about one of my favorite artists, MF Doom. And we are here with the author of the book. Thanks for joining us. Do you want to give the listeners a little bit of a background on your career and how you came to write a book about Doom?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, as we were talking before, I kind of came up in New York. I started there at journalism school at Columbia, and then I moved to Brooklyn. And my first book, I got a book deal right out of journalism school. My first book was called The New Beats, Exploring the Music, Culture, and Attitudes of Hip Hop, which came out in 94 on Anchor Doubleday. And, you know, prior to that, I had been one of the early writers for The Source magazine, which was like one of the first magazines to document the hip hop culture. And then during the 90s, I just started writing for all the magazines. There was a ton of magazines back then: Vibe, The Source, Rolling Stone, Spin. You know, unfortunately, most of those aren't around anymore except like Rolling Stone. Mm-hmm. But there was a lot of publications, and, you know, hip hop was just kind of emerging into the mainstream. So I was like one of the early writers to like be on the scene. And it was fun times back then, you know, because like obviously New York was the center of the hip hop universe, and a lot of artists lived there. In my neighborhood in Brooklyn, there was a lot of artists living. I live right around the corner from Biggie Smalls.
Oh, you're in Best
Eye. And yeah. And, you know, I used to run into dudes on the subway all the time. It was just a really cool time to be in New York and to be covering hip hop. And then, you know, eventually I went on to other things. But more recently, like in 2021, I wrote a book about Wu-Tang called From the Streets of Shaolin, the Wu-Tang Saga, because obviously I'd spent a lot of time with them in the 90s. And then this book on Doom is like the follow-up to that. Wu-Tang was like one of my favorite groups at the time, and Doom is probably one of my favorite artists of all time, so I had to do a book on him. So that's how this book ended up coming out. Obviously I was very you know, kind of surprised and shocked when I heard about Doom's death in 2020. And I had just finished writing the Wu-Tang book, so I was like looking for something else to do. So this kind of just showed up on my plate, and I kind of segued right into it, you know? So
did you know Doom back in the day?
You know, that's funny. I've met, you know, probably 100 artists back in the 90s, and Doom was not one of them. He was kind of a low key character even back then.
Yeah, notoriously reclusive.
Yeah. You know, obviously I was a huge fan of KMD, which was Doom's original group when he was Zev Love X, he and his brother Sub Rock. And I had gone to, I didn't go. They never had a release party for the second record, Black Bastards, but I got the advanced cassette in the mail right before it came out. And that was like, I remember at the time, that was like a record that like everyone in the Source was like really looking forward to, because it was like, it was a banging record, first of all. And it was like, you know, the follow-up to their first album. They had matured more. And everyone was looking forward to that record, and it never came out. So it was kind of, and that's when Doom kind of went on. He dropped off the radar. You know, he lost his deal, lost his brother, and he kind of disappeared for several years. And that record actually was re-released, I think, in 2000.
Yeah, I had never heard KMD until I read this book. You know, I like Doom. I think I'm sort of a typical case of a lot of Doom fans who, you know, I was getting into, you know, expanding my musical tastes in high school in the early aughts, and I was mostly into punk and indie stuff, like what the kids are calling indie sleaze now. And there was never like a huge hip hop crossover there. That, you know, there's always some appreciation for Wu-Tang and stuff like that. But I just vividly recall MF Doom being the main crossover band that everybody loved. And if you didn't know about him already, he started popping up on Adult Swim. And those records were just really great. And it's still something that I come back to a lot. And so it was great to learn more about him, learn more about, you know, learn about KMD and like blast those albums while I was reading the book. And also learning a good amount about the history of hip hop in the early chapters. So I thought maybe I'd start with a little question there. This, you know, predates the narrative of the book, but there's a sort of maybe apocryphal story about hip hop's origins that I was always curious how true that is. People say that during the 77 blackout, there was, you know, obviously looting all over the city, including in the Bronx. And people say that, you know, hardware stores and music stores were robbed and people got their turntables and mixers there that made the first beats for hip hop. Do you think that's a true story or is it apocryphal?
Oh, yeah, I think that's true. And that's coming from people like Grandmaster Caz, you know, from Cold Crush Brothers, who was around back then. And I also know, like, you know, I used to hang out with a lot of these old school heads like Jazzy J, you know, original Zulu Nation DJ, obviously Africa Bambaataa. And so I used to get those stories from them, too. So that's definitely real. Like that's the 77 blackout, you know, these are, you know, people don't realize that. That's why I had to put a lot of context into this book. Because people don't realize where hip hop started. You know, it started off from poor black and Hispanic kids in a certain section of the Bronx. These guys didn't have money for musical instruments, much less turntables at the time. So when the blackout came, you know, everyone went out to like all these audio stores, and that was like the first shit that they looted was like turntables and mixers and stuff like that. And, you know, yeah, that was definitely a part of the origin story of hip hop. You know, it's like, that's why we love hip hop, because it was a rebel art form. You know, it was like, you know, steal this, you know, it's like, even like KRS back in the day was like, you know, steal my records, you know, it was like total that type of DIY rebel mentality.
Yeah, and if listeners want to read more about that history, there's a great book called Love Goes to a Building on Fire that talks about the origins of hip-hop, but it also talks about the origins of, like, disco, punk, minimal, ambient, like a bunch of genres and art forms all appearing at the exact same time, late 70s in New York City, and that's just a great book. But this book actually tends to focus on the second generation of hip-hop, the more Gen X generation, the first generation that you write, grew up fully immersed in the hip-hop culture. And it was really fun reading about Doom and his brother's youth in Long Beach, Long Island, which is, I think, coincidentally also where Rick Rubin is from.
Yeah, he went to Long Beach High, too, yeah.
And, you know, one thing I was really fascinated with that I want to spend a little bit of time talking to you about is his... him growing up in a 5%er family and then later becoming a New Albion.
He wasn't quite, his family was actually Nation of Islam.
Okay.
Yeah. Louis Farrakhan, Nation of Islam. The 5%ers are kind of a splinter group off the Nation of Islam. And really the main difference that I would say is in the Nation of Islam, you know, it's all about Elijah Muhammad was the prophet. But in the 5%ers, which is also called the Nation of Gods and Earths, the guy who started the 5%ers, Clarence 13X Smith, who was a member of Malcolm X Mosque Number 7 in Harlem, he actually said that the black man is God in the flesh. The original man, the black man is God. So that's a huge shift from like the Nation of Islam, you know, but they follow the same philosophy in the way, because like the Nation of Islam has this thing called the 120 lessons, which is like a question and answer session between Elijah Muhammad. And the kind of five percenters is kind of like the street version of the Nation of Islam. They made these 120 lessons available to the kids on the street, you know? And so Doom was, you know, Doom's family, like his father, I believe, was Nation of Islam. And they, you know, they went to like the mosques and everything like that. And then later on, kind of Doom graduated to the five, gravitated towards the five percenters, although he wasn't officially a five percenter. And then, as you said, into the Nuwabian Nation, which is like some other shit completely. It's got nothing to do with Nation of Islam or five percenters, but it's, you know, kind of somewhat related.
Yeah. And I'm really fascinated with, you know, this trajectory, you know, from Nation of Islam to five percenters to the Nuwabians, and then to just him creating his own kind of mythos around comic books and Godzilla movies and that sort of thing. But just sticking with the five percenter Nuwabian origins, I'm familiar with the five percenters both from a lot of hip hop references. Like you said, if you hear people calling each other God in lyrics, that's probably a five percenter thing. And I read Michael Muhammad's Night's excellent book about them.
That's an excellent book. Yeah. That's deep.
And then the Nuwabians, I know from their magnificent temple on Bushwick Avenue that you also talk about in the book. And I don't know if you ever got a chance to peek in there, but sometimes they, when they're having their, I don't know what to call it, ceremonies or sessions, you can, they leave the door open a crack and you can peek in there. And it's really beautiful inside. It looks like a Kenneth Anger movie. You know, it's something to see. I know this is not for me.
Around?
You
know? Yeah. Is it still around today?
This is sad, or maybe not sad, depending on your feelings about the Nuwabians, but they have a for sale sign out front. And I know they still have membership. I see them walking around with the big Ankh and going in and out of there.
Wow. I didn't even know that they were still around in Bushwick, because, you know, they eventually moved to Atlanta after moving upstate. But mm-hmm. I had, back in the day, actually, Afrika Bambaataa was a huge follower of Dr. York. So I went with Bambaataa to the bookstore in Bushwick, and I bought a few of their pamphlets and stuff like that.
All eyes
real
on
wild
Egypt.
Stuff.
Yeah.
If rap was sucker, I'll be Pele. Scoring hard, I eat no pork chops a lot. So trust in me because you're trusting God. The more better blues just began for this man. Cause the bills stay paid from this mic within my hand. I'm not your average everyday cotton picking a bale and hay. Whole tricking brother who likes to eat chicken. Anyway, just hum along as the drummer drums along. This I bring along, not to sing.
It was kind of like a hipster rite of passage to go into that bookstore and like try to talk to them and just have them be mean to you, because it's not for white people. That is kind of the point. I never did it myself. You know, I kept a respectful distance. If the five percenters were like this individual six step away from Nation of Islam, it seems like the Nuwabians were more of like a return to like the esoteric cult form. Dr. York was building this Egyptian city upstate where he eventually got busted for a wide litany of charges of abuse and rape, and he is now serving life in prison. And you say the group has gotten much smaller since then. But what do you think that this trajectory from, you know, Garveyism through Black Power to these sects, what does it say about hip hop, or like the ideological environment that hip hop came up in?
Well, it's like, I kind of see it like, I kind of see it same as like reggae and Rastafarianism. You know, reggae is not just music. It's got the whole Rasta ideology gives it more of a spiritual foundation. And the same with hip hop, I think, because hip hop is like you know, post civil rights, I see like the Nation of Islam and Five Percenters and the all of the Nuwabi and shit is kind of almost like the spiritual background of hip hop in a way, you know, because it all goes back to black empowerment. You know what I'm saying? It's like people who were treated like shit were like, you know, they went back and they dug in their history and they just kind of cherry pick whatever appealed to them. You know, especially someone like Dr. York, because he has like little bits of everything in there.
And always changing so too, you know, he rebrand himself.
Yeah, he's constantly changing too. And, you know, even though Dr. York is kind of like an unsavory character, I think a lot of the information that he accessed is like valid stuff. You know what I'm saying? And I think I think Doom latched on to a lot of that stuff and he just took it and ran with it. And as you said, he kind of developed his own ideology out of that. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's valid stuff. You know, you know, you could hear some outlandish stuff like that the Nation of Islam believes that, you know, that white people were genetically modified out of the original man's genes. But then you hear about stuff like on like Ancient Aliens, how the whole human race could be genetically modified from aliens, you know? Right. So it's like there's kernels of truth in there, you know.
Yaqub like, was a real person. There is pardon? Dr. Yaqub was a real person. There is some basis in history for that. And I mentioned this on the show earlier that, you know, one of my favorite KRS-One songs is Why Is That, which is a very fun song explaining why Moses was black and why why his people were black. And I heard this song and, you know, I was raised Jewish and I thought, yeah, I have no problem with this narrative of history. Maybe I'll even entertain it. And I looked it up. I looked up, you know, Moses' history. And according to the scholars, the consensus is that Moses did not, in fact, exist and that there were no Jews living as slaves in Egypt. So his interpretation is as valid as anyone else's, you know.
Exactly. And if you look at the people from that part of the world, they're not white, you know. Yeah. I mean, like,
they're certainly not white.
You can say that about Jesus even. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? It's like Jesus was Palestinian, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's like,
so
yeah, so history as we know it is all twisted and modified to suit who's ever in power, really. Everything is like that. Just as a kind of a tangent, last night I was watching this show on History Channel called The West, narrated by Kevin Costner about the history of the Native Americans. And it's crazy the shit that they went through. You know, it's like crazy what the original settlers did to claim this land as America. I mean, it's like, and that stuff is not taught in school. So no. You really have to. Hip hop is like that. It's about self-study. It's about going off in these different tangents and digging deep because, as I said, the history that is written is twisted. It's not, you know, probably how things actually were.
Yeah, and so getting back to Doom a bit, a really nice connection that you make sort of between the more religious origins of Doom and his family and then his kind of the mythos that he creates from like comic books, nerd culture, is Sun Ra, which he's connected through Madlib. Was really into Sun Ra, or at least the Mad Villain album. Mm-hmm. And then you've got this great quote from Sun Ra about black people themselves being a myth. And I think Sun Ra is still such an inspiration today because his vision was creating something like a cult, although, you know, I've never really heard any stories of like the kind of abuse that's typical in cults, but also a very like clearly artistic project, like a clearly a sort of sci-fi Afrofuturist project that actually was rooted in material black empowerment. It wasn't simply like a concept for a band, but, right. you know, constantly creating from other faiths and traditions and the black power tradition, its own community and its own world and its own artistic medium. And I think this was something that you see in MF Doom's work, like where he does reference his, you know, spiritual background in these groups, but also it's very esoteric and it's ever evolving. And it's like side by side with audio clips from Hanna-Barbera cartoons and stuff like that. So yeah, maybe staying with that for a second before we get to Doom's later career. His father, I think, or was his mother, was from Zimbabwe, and he was born in London. But I don't remember anything in the book about him actually like having a phase where he wanted to get in touch with his African roots. Did he ever have that moment where he, you know, went to Africa or was interested in that?
Yeah, that's kind of funny. I would have thought, you know, being so, you know, pro-black and everything, I would have thought that he would have had more of a contact with the African side of his heritage. I did try to talk to his father. I was unsuccessful in trying to reach him. The only member of Doom's family that I was able to talk to were his younger brother, Dimbaza, who's like a fount of information, and also his cousin Michelle. Mm-hmm. But I know Doom's father was like a serious activist, you know, coming from South Africa and also being here in the 60s and, you know, being exposed to the civil rights movement and everything. And it's funny, I heard a story about Doom doing a show in South Africa. This was a recent story I heard from, it was like, you know, Brother Ali from Rhymesayers. And he was like, when Doom was in Africa, when he was in South Africa, he like barely left the hotel room, you know, and that's like another quirk of Doom. Like he was like super low key. And he said, like, he went to Doom's hotel room and knocked on the door and he said, man, Doom, like we're in Africa, man. Don't you want to like come out and check it out? And he said, like, Doom came out of the hotel room and just like took a big whiff of the air. And he was like, oh yeah, Africa. And he just like went back into his room, you know. It's like, so, you know, it's like,
yeah, he didn't have the Malcolm X experience.
He was such a quirky guy. Like, you know, I wouldn't even dream of trying to get into his head because he was such a inscrutable character that way. You know, it's like, and, you know, even though Doom was into all of this stuff, as you said, all of this esoteric information, you're very hard pressed to really find it in his rhymes. You know, it was like, it definitely informed him, but it's not something that is so obvious in his music, in the same way that Wu-Tang put all the 5% stuff into their music. You know what I'm saying? Doom was compartmentalized in a way, you know? And like in the book, I said, towards the end of his life, just from talking to the people that I know, he was much more into this esoteric research than he was into music, I believe, wow, towards the end of his life, you know? So it's like, it's compartmentalized. You can see some of it bleeding over, but with Doom, he had a definite, you know, the music was one thing, the knowledge was something else. So, So yeah, to answer your question, I didn't really find a definite through line to Africa as far as he was concerned. But for that matter, you know, his mother was from Trinidad. His father was from Zimbabwe. Right. You don't really see him kind of. He did actually at one time live in the Caribbean. I don't know exactly where, but he did. When he left England, he did live in the Caribbean for some time. I don't know if it was. We don't know exactly where it was, but.
Sean, we are just sort of the mid period of Doom's career, 1993, Sub Rock from KMD passes away, so that kind of ends that project. And then also there was this interesting moment of censorship from, what was it, Elektra, their major label, because KMD liked to use the Sambo imagery in their work. Mm-hmm. And then on the Black, was it the Black Bastards album, where they used an image of Sambo being lynched, kind of humorously, but they were making a point about black art and living as a black person in the USA. But it was too much for the major label. And that story reminded me a lot of Steve Albini's MRR article from around the same time, where he encouraged bands and artists that they'd have a better course of success in the indie world than the majors, because you wouldn't have to deal with this micromanagement from the label, and you wouldn't be ripped off to the same degree, so you actually have a better chance of making more money. So yeah, what did that KMD experience, how did that affect Doom and influence his career in the 90s into the fame that he finally emerged to in the aughts?
Oh, well, it was huge for him, because here he is, like 18, 19, he's got a major label deal on, you know, Elektra. And then all of a sudden, as you said, because of the censorship, they didn't allow that album to come out. Black Bastards, it was kind of like a play on the Hangman game, basically, you know, where it says they're spelling out Black Bastards, not all the letters are there. And then they hung the Sambo character. And what that represented was, for Doom, he was hanging the stereotype of what black people were considered, you know, this like shucking and jiving, big lips.
His name was Little Sambo.
Uh-oh, Zeo's exercising his right to be hostile.
They always try to say that coon is me.
I don't understand, man.
You don't understand.
No, I don't know.
My temper's up to like 10. When switched up his thoughts that I recommend. Minus his flood, but thicker as blood. Plus still some stay stud like sticks in the mud. Ibuprofen from nuclears keep me from flipping. Daily, yet I constantly slip into thinking, kind of loony. In my logo, you see us. Whoever said that cone was me.
He was hanging that stereotype, but ironically, it was two black writers who took offense at that. They just saw the lynching aspect of it, and you know, because of all the other controversies that were happening at the time, I go into it in that chapter, like the Ice-T cop killer thing, and there's a whole bunch of other controversies because of that. The censorship happened, and Doom loses his major label deal. And as you see in the rest of his career, he never went back to a major label. It was all about indie labels, and that worked out really well for him, because the whole reason we have MF Doom on so many labels was he wasn't restricted to one label now, because indie labels, you're not signed to like a multi-year deal on where you can only put out records on this one label. Now he put out so many different records on so many different labels, and that worked out great for him. And it ties into what Steve Albini said, you could make more money on indie labels. You know what I'm saying? If you're doing it at that level, and you know, obviously for an album like Mad Villainy, which was on Stone's Throw, that sold a bunch of copies. The Mouse and the Mask also, you know, sold like 350,000 copies. I know for a fact, I used to run an indie label myself, Word Sound. And, you know, if you own the rights to the music and everything, you don't have to sell that many copies to be making money. You know, you could sell 5,000, 10,000 copies, you're still making money. So why sell your masters to a major label and have to pimp yourself to this whole corporate structure who they don't give a shit about you anyway? You know, I mean, look at what's happening to the major music industry now. Look at the whole Diddy trial and everything.
Oh, it's like, oh yeah. I do want to ask you about that a little bit later. I'm curious your thoughts about that.
So, you know, the Doom was like total indie head, you know, and that's where punk rock and hip hop intersect, because actually hip hop started out on indie labels, you know. It just got really big and commercial really fast. And, you know, people were into the big advances and stuff like that. But for a guy like Doom, who had like a multi-year career, it worked out great for him, you know, owning his own stuff and being able to put out his own stuff, and then eventually owning his own label, Metal Face, which is still around today. And his wife is reaping the benefits of that, putting out, re-releasing his music independently and doing very well with it. That's so great. You know, more power to him, more power to independent artists. You don't have to, as we can see, this whole corporate structure is the problem with America, right? It's like corporations own America. Corporations own the political system. You know, we have to break that in order to have any type of hope for the future, because it ain't working. It's not sustainable, you know? So
yeah, there's there was I really like the note at the end about like how the mask, the Doom mask, has become sort of this symbol of that ethos in hip hop. And part of his origin story of reemerging as MF Doom around 99-2000 is that he had something like a vow of revenge on the hip hop establishment, and returns as this archetype that you call the bad man, a uniquely African American anti-hero typified by Stagger Lee, and returning in hip hop as like the gangsta kingpin personified by Biggie and Nas. But Doom idiosyncratically chooses a comic book villain for this character. So what do you think the significance of that choice is, and what does it tell us about Doom?
Well, you know, Doom was really into, in addition to cartoons, he was really into Marvel Comics. And I do a whole pretty deep dive into the whole Marvel universe, which is pretty deep, because Marvel was the first comic book company to like come out with these kind of conflicted heroes, you know, like Spider-Man and people like that, who had like super abilities, but they also had human flaws, human frailties. So you could identify with them more. They were not just like some god, you know? So Doom took that and he ran with it, but he became the anti-hero, you know? He was and like you said, in black culture, it's all about like the anti-hero, you know, because blacks were kind of iced out from mainstream society. So they had to, you know, kind of exist on the outside. And all of these guys, Nas, Escobar, you know, Biggie Smalls, they're portraying themselves as bad guys, but like drug dealers. So Doom said, I'm going to be the ultimate bad guy. I'm going to be the super villain, you know? So he found that template in the Marvel universe with Dr. Doom. And he really, to me, he was really true to that character, because he knew Dr. Doom well, because he knew the Marvel comics, and he knew that Dr. Doom was like the guy who's the ultimate anti-hero. He's the killer who loves children, you know, like Doom described himself. He's only bad because he's against these guys, the Fantastic Four, you know. But at the same time, when Doom takes over and rules the world, when Dr. Doom, the character, rules the world, one of the first things he does is abolish apartheid in South Africa. Mm. So how much of a bad guy is he really, you know? So Doom really played with that, you know, there's a fine line between good and bad. There's a fine line between genius and crazy. He really played with that a lot, which is ingenious, because other dudes were just like, oh yeah, I'm just going to be like a drug dealer. That's going to be my persona. And just Doom just took it. Doom had such imagination that he just took it to the extreme, you know?
Yeah,
and like he did that with all his characters. Look at King Ghidorah.
Uh-huh.
You know, he embodied this three-headed dragon from outer space who was like the...
From the Godzilla like, mythos. Or
yeah, what, Godzilla's yeah. anti-hero. Because eventually, you know, Godzilla started out as a bad guy, but eventually he became a good guy, right? If you follow the Godzilla franchise, which is like the biggest movie franchise of all time. So Doom was like really paid attention to this stuff. You know, it's like he really paid attention to this stuff. So that's why you really have to pay attention to what he's doing and his lyrics and his whole concept, because there's so many different levels to it, you know, which I kind of broke down in the book. That's why I had to take a time out from his kind of his bio to like have a chapter on the Godzilla movies, have a chapter on Dr. York, have a chapter on the Marvel universe. Cause you know, Marvel today, we think of these like kind of vacuous superhero movies, that multi-billion-dollar superhero movies, you know, but there's so much deeper than that. You know, if you get down to the nitty gritty, and Doom was like focused on that.
Yeah, and it sounds like you mentioned that there was like this drug kingpin archetype in like the gangster rap explosion in the 90s, and Doom during this time, it sounds like he was dealing drugs to some extent and like briefly did some jail time and beat the charge. But yeah, that was never, you know, he mentions it in his lyrics, but it seems like that was never really, that was just like sort of part of the background of his life. It wasn't like important.
Yeah, a lot of rappers define themselves by that. And I can see why, because like, you know, the 80s was the crack era. And that's when a lot of these guys came up. And that's, you know, definitely, if you look at a group like Wu-Tang, half of these guys were crack dealers, you know? So that was part of their life, you know? So what else are you going to talk about, you know? So for Doom, he was almost ashamed of it, you know, because Doom was a middle-class kid from Long Island. He came from a stable home. He had two parents, you know, he used to ride BMX bikes and skateboard and all that. That was not part of his reality. So he was almost ashamed of that. And also when Doom dealt drugs, he was dealing like psychedelics and acid and mushrooms and mescaline and stuff like that. So he was not like a street corner crack dealer, you know, like he was different in that way. And that was never part of his, he never defined himself by that. That was never part of his identity. So that's another way that he was so different than, you know, than the pack of rappers, you know.
Let the revolution, let the thanks bust and thank us. When the smoke clear and you can see the sky again, there will be the chopped off heads of Leviathan. My friend, call them strangers. Anybody talk to them, end up in some danger. Can't reform them.
Yeah. So Sean came up around the same time as I did, and like the, you know, the sort of Williamsburg scene and the aughts. What are your memories of Doom around that time, Sean?
My memories are cloudy around that period. Watching live music, attending events and shows and stuff like that, but it kind of all washed over me like a, I don't know, like a tide or something. My brain washed away, I think, with that. But that said, I'm struck by being brought back in time to this period of the 80s and the 90s and the aughts. And one thing that you guys were talking about before was this great racket, you know, that exists in the major record labels. This great racket that all of us have been fortunate to see the real death of. Maybe not like the complete death of, but I'm brought back to the late 90s and early 2000s and all of the controversies and all of the pushback against digital music and downloading music. And I feel like we passed through a moment of great change within music. that's elicited in this story, in this book of yours. And I think maybe in the 90s and 2000s, we would have seen this as like corporate music versus like indie rock. And there was a way to carve your space out with like independent shows, you know, as MF Doom and many people have. But it feels like we've even seen the back end of that struggle now. Like things have kind of come around again, where I was looking on eBay and you can get the Black Bastards CD, the original press of Black Bastards for $199 on eBay. But if you want the LP, it's $250. But like we've moved full circle now where it feels like material culture is coming back, where like the actual commodity of the record or the CD is coming back. And I wonder if that maybe... how cognizant of these great historical changes we are in music and how that affects how we feel about music. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about that. That's the kind of general place I want to think about. What do you think, Andy?
Well, I love collecting records. I don't understand the CD collection. But I do worry that maybe young people don't know about like Soulseek and that you can just download this stuff and have it and edit it and stuff. And I know like they're into like YouTube to MP3, but yeah, anyone can download Soulseek and get any album you want right away. It works really well. And there's, you know, you don't have to worry about the RIAA or anything like that. So yeah.
Yeah. But what happens if, when there's like a big, like EMP attack and like all digital shit is gone and you only have your vinyl now.
That's why I collect records, for the apocalypse.
Or CDs, for that matter. I mean, I was against CDs when they first came out, but they're actually kind of convenient.
Yeah.
Actually, it's like a physical product. So I don't think that will ever die, because you always have it. You know, you always have it. Digital shit is kind of like, how many times have I lost my everything on my hard drive? You know, it's like, thank God I have all the backups, you know?
Dude, I think about that in like even a broader sense, which is like, you know, you can go to eBay or you can go to an independent CD and record store and you can pick up this, like these physical commodities, you know, that still exist in time. And through all of the 20th century and the 19th century, there were sheaths of paper that people bound together into magazines and books and whatnot. I feel like so much of the culture that we've created over the last 20 years or so, if there was an EMP disaster, like an event, right, and these hard drives were wiped out, historians would look back at this period as like a dark age, because very few remnants of this time left, because we've kind of made these repositories, which are very ephemeral. They're digital, right, by their very nature. And that can't help but affect, I think, music, right, and how we encounter it. And this great distinction that Andy brought up, an important one, between like the ease and convenience and the reproducibility and the editability, is not really a word, of digital music versus like this hard, you know, like vinyl with grooves in it that a needle spins around in, or a CD with like however the hell CDs work. I don't know. I think the only time I've ever seen how a CD works is when I've put one in the microwave before, which is a fun party trick. But yeah, no, what do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, like, hip hop would never have started without this, you know? This is
pulling up a record label right now.
Seminal to hip hop. And I think it's kind of a shame now that people are charging like $200 for, I mean, that's gouging, you know? That's like, who's going to pay $200 for a single piece? Well, I paid like $40 for this one, and I'm like,
what's that one?
This is Ghost Dubs, okay, extended versions. I was listening to it on like Spotify, and then I always want to support the artist, so I buy the stuff, but this is not the same version. So I'm like, so I'm still listening to the Spotify version, but
yeah, we had an episode about Spotify recently.
And I can see that with Doom too. Like a lot of his vinyl and stuff like that is just like exorbitant prices. Like, you know,
I'm going to track some down after reading the book, though, for sure. So, yeah, let's try to wrap up his career a little bit. And then I want to ask some other questions about hip hop and, you know, stay on these, you know, questions about the culture and the way people consume it, I suppose. So throughout the aughts, he gets more and more popular in the indie hip hop world. And then he meets this artist in Philadelphia who's connected with the Fort Thunder scene in Providence, which I'm always so fascinated about that as like this cultural nexus in the aughts, because it was involved with Crime Think, which was like an anarchist group that we've been pretty influenced by. It had these amazing comic book artists there.
Crime Think?
Yeah, Crime Think. I heard a story that Fort Thunder was a squat started by Crime Think people. I'm not sure if that's totally true, but it was a big warehouse in Providence where a lot of artists lived for free or for very cheap. And one of them, I forgot his name, but you talk about him in the book. He links up with Doom in Philadelphia, and they start making music that becomes a big crossover hit in the punk scene. And that seemed to be his bridge to the more indie hipster culture, right?
Yeah, sure. And it's just like, to me, it's just like what happened in England in the late 70s with punk and reggae. You know, yeah. So I just saw this movie on Criterion Channel called Rude Boy, which is a movie about the Clash. And punk was intertwined with reggae culture at the time, you know.
That's where
same thing here in New York. Punk was intertwined with the hip hop scene. Absolutely. In the 70s. You know, Bambada used to go up, or like all these dudes like Malcolm McLaren used to go up to the Bronx to see what Bambada was doing, you know, and then when hip hop was downtown, it was like they were checking out the punk. So it's just these rebel cultures seeing that they are, you know, like-minded and seeing that they have stuff in common, you know, it's just like that. Like-minded people will always find each other. She did a cool hula hoop, but don't get any on you. It's all a big scam to make y'all eat pig ham. When he's on the mic, he's like the trigger man. Fig jam, doom. Not to be confused with nobody, especially since the flows he used were so nutty. Never too woozy to go study. Crews got no clues like old cruddy Officer McGillicuddy.
Hey folks, Sean KB here. Just a reminder that our show relies on your support. So if you enjoy what we do and you want to hear more excellent bonus content, you can become a patron at patreon.com/theantifada. It's cheap, there's a ton of content, and it would mean everything to us. So thank you, and we'll see you behind the paywall. Is that true? Match from hat to shoe. Snafu, snatch any brew, the bat's blue. Black true, like that's new. Catch me through. No latch attached, catch shoe, catch 22. Super. He's loaded dice nice and overpriced. The arm and the leg, all me life, all your ice. Villain, nag a grieving old hag. Snag a bragger, buys Mike Cord and leave him holding the bag. Come clean, a bunch of dumb mean cream puffs. A keen drum machine buff.